My name is Jack Sage. The name of my session is Washington History. Tonight's session will be on wagon trains, pioneers, railroading, and related subjects. Before we start, I've been interested in politics for a long time and made a mistake and ran a few times and got elected a few times to local offices. But in 1869, Montana was going to select a capital. And so all these little districts voted. One of them was Summit. It had 150 voters. They got 600 votes out of it. Junction had 20 voters. They got 200 votes. Wigwam Creek had 4 voters, and they got 250 votes. Needless to say, they threw all those ballots out. Yeah, it sounds like they. I think maybe Chicago learned from Montana. I have Montana is where one of my ancestors. In fact, I have a book that put out. I did on my Oregon Trail relatives, and one of the 9 children ended up with the hands of the vigilantes in 1864, which I'll be mentioning. I don't know if I'll do that tonight or not. I'll start out on religion in the Northwest. They always said the state of Washington was a prime prospect for evangelism because we were probably the poorest church state in the Union. They figure that we have about 75% of our people have no church relationships. With only 31% of our population as now, this is in 1989, only 31% of the population belongs to a church or a synagogue. The state ranks 48th in the nation, and this is from a 1989 survey. That puts us pretty near the bottom. Jason Lee, and on the side here, afterwards, I have some pictures of, I hate to, you're leaning against it, Paul, but there's Methodists pictures. But there's some pictures. We put out Northwest History about 20 years ago, and it's a little out of date. But there's some pictures of the early Methodist people, so I will not mention too much in the class. I have a lot on Lutherans, and so we'll get to that. And one of the, Jason Lee came, you can remember when we had 4 Indians came out to Washington, D.C. looking for the one to learn the white man's language. And Jason Lee was one of the first ones to answer it. And he came out to the Willamette Valley in 1834. He was not an American as such. He came from Quebec. In those days, if you had to became a missionary, you had to be married. And so he married, I think he had about 3 wives, finally. Not at all at the same time, but one after the But every one of them died in childbirth, and it was pretty tough in those days. One of the early teachers of the white culture was an Indian named Spokane Gary, and he was a Spokane tribal member. And when he was a young man, the Presbyterians got a hold of him, and they took him to a school near Winnipeg, Canada, where he was there for several years. And then in 1829, he returned to Spokane, and he taught Christianity among many of the Indian tribes. Now, that was the first missionary that we had, and that actually wasn't sent out by anybody, except possibly the Presbyterian Church did influence him. St. Peter's Church, built in 1873 in Tacoma, is still in use. Some of us have seen it. I've had tour groups go there. It cost $300 to build. They used a cheap thing for a pulpit or altar, or not an altar, but a tower. They used a tree, a living tree, and the ivy's climbed up. And it's still there and still have services. It's Episcopalian. The tiny church, and we have a church in Kawada in Chehalis, and that's the oldest standing Protestant church, and it was built in 1858. And it's still used for weddings and things like that. During her 45-year mission in Washington, Mother Joseph, who was a Catholic, established 11 hospitals, 7 academies, 5 Indian schools, and 2 orphanages in several Northwest states and territories and in British Columbia. Mother Joseph, a Catholic nun, began her work of mercy in Washington Territory in 1856, and she died in 1902, and is now honored with a statue in the nation's capital and the state capital. She is one of the few women to have a statue in the Washington, D.C. Each state is entitled to 2. We have Marcus Whitman was the first one, and then Mother Joseph. I was raised in a little town of Sprague in eastern Washington. She built a school there, academy, and they call it St. Joseph Academy. In Steilacoom, where I live, and where a couple others do live here, she built a convent and a school for a lot of the Catholic children. And it was next to the Catholic Church, which was moved there in 1864 from Fort Steilacoom. Now, I have some maps up here, and these are early missions. I've got 2 maps. I have numbers up here. These numbers are circled to help me. There's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 Methodists, Protestant. There were a few others besides Methodists in there. The earliest one was Wailapu near Walla Walla, number 2 here. That is where the Whitman Mission was, and that was established about 1838, or actually 36. Then the group that came after that, Spokane, which is up above in number 6 up here, and that was Tishamaikum. And that was about 1839. What happened, they had some missionaries, they had 4 women came west. And there's a wonderful book about these 4 women who came west as missionaries. All together, they spent the first winter with Marcus Whitman and Narcissa Whitman. And then they spread out. 2 of them went to Spokane, and another one went down to Spalding, which is at Lapway, just across the line from Washington. I think we were looking, here's Nia Bay. We were looking at the map the other day. We have an island out here that's, and this is the furthest point in the contiguous states of the United States. Alaska, of course, and Hawaii are further west, but that's the furthest point you can get. Between here and Vancouver Island is the Straits of Juan de Fuca. It wasn't discovered, although many sailing vessels sailed by it. This was a tough route, and our early missionaries had to come by boat. I'll give you a few others while I'm up here. Fort Nisqually, near where I live, and it's down right here. This is Olympia, where I got my finger. This is end of Puget Sound. Puget Sound runs up in here. This would probably show a little bit better. This is Puget Sound. And Fort Nisqually is a reasonable looking picture of it. This is a fort that was built by the Hudson Bay Company. Hudson Bay Company built that one. They built one down in Vancouver. They built one at Walla Walla. And they built one at Spokane. They built them in various places. They're all the same. They weren't for military uses. They were to protect their trading goods from the Indians. The Indians just loved to borrow things, as they called it. And so they had to have palisades and guardhouses to protect. After the first ones were Protestants that came out west. And then the Catholics started coming, and the first one is in the Collet's Toledo area, St. Francis. And then most of them were down in the Yakima Valley, up in Colville, which is up in here. Yakima Valley is down in, here's Ellensburg and here's Yakima. This is where I was born, this is where my mother was born, and they had a ranch halfway up between there that was a part of the wilderness area. If I only had one copy of this, if anybody's interested, I was going to make more copies. I had some last year and everybody took them, so I forgot to make them this year. Okay, Are there any comments at all on the missions? Now, there, we have them all over the state, as you can see, these red dots. So if you happen to be traveling, the closest one we have here is, there's one near Wenatchee, and that was a Catholic one. And that was called St. Francis Xavier. It's at Kashmir. Now, some of us have stopped at Kashmir. And that is one of the older ones. It was 1873, and it was a Catholic one. Yakima had Autumn Mission near, and that's this one here. I spent one winter after World War II near the mission in a labor camp because I had no housing available in World War II. And so my wife and our two kids stayed in a single-walled labor camp for a winter. And that was probably, it was cold. And so I've never forgotten that. If there's no more comments, I'll go over what the early missionaries did in the Northwest. In the late 1830s, some missionaries were sponsored by the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, and the religious denominations of the board were Congregational, Presbyterian, and the Dutch Reformed Church. The missions were set up at Lapaway, which is on the Lewiston, near the Lewiston-Clarkston area, and that was the Nez Perce. And we probably had more success with the Nez Perce than any other Indian tribe, especially in eastern Washington. The Eliza and Henry Spaulding were the first ones at Lapaway. Henry had the printing press. He printed the first really parts of the New Testament. He printed the Flathead language on it, which was circulated to all the missions in the Northwest. There was no Indian language as such, except possibly the Flathead language, which was Flathead was the basic language. Dr. Marcus Whitman and Narcissa Prentice, they got married just before they came west, and she married the first guy that would ask her, evidently, because. And she was a very intelligent person. She'd gone to a seminary and everything else. And the same way with Mary Walker, who was my favorite. And she was married to Elkanah Walker. And they went to Spokane, to Shamiakin, along with Reverend Cushing and Myra Ells. The Whitmans arrived in 1836 among the Cayuse Indians. Their mission was located along the Oregon Trail, and their efforts at converting the Cayuses were not too successful. They were probably the least sick ones to be converted of all the Indian tribes in the Northwest. The Whitmans, however, even though they didn't convert the Cayuses, were very successful in assisting the early wagon trains, which included the one that my great-great-grandparents and grandmother came on. Many of the travelers were nearly destitute after they traveled 2,000 miles, and so they got supplies from Whitman's, because he had, as you know, the Walla Walla Valley has a good agriculture area, and so they raised all their own food. The missions were only allowed $300 a year to spend, and they fed, Whitman's fed probably several thousand people during their time. $300 didn't go very far, so they had what they called missionary barrels. And all the churches, you know, from the back east would fill a barrel with clothing. Now we put it in rummage sales, but then they put it in barrels and sent it to the missions. The Whitmans cared for a lot of people. The Sagers were probably the most well-known persons. They were orphaned on the trail and had seven children. And they stayed at the mission until the massacre of 1847, November 29th. All the boys in the family were killed by the Indians. All the males that were at the Whitman mission at the time were killed. The women and children, young ones, were taken as hostages. And after about a month, they were paid off with blankets and oxen and guns and ammunition and so forth before they were finally released. One of the persons that did that was Dr. McLaughlin of the Fort Vancouver Hudson Bay Company. He's the one that negotiated the release of the families. The Spauldings were stationed at this mission in Lapaway, Henry Spaulding and Eliza, and they're still buried there. They have there's an Indian cemetery, and I've been to it, and they're still there. But they did convert a few people. And probably the best known was Timothy. And I'll mention a little later about Timothy next Thursday when I get into the Indians and the Indian Wars. Timothy was a good convert. He was actually taught by Eliza. Now, most of the men in the missions, they spent their time gadding. I mean, they went from place to place. So it was up to the women to do all the teaching and the training, and even some of the preaching, which the men objected to because they thought that wasn't for a woman to do. But this Timothy, that was his Christian name, he often ended his prayers as saying, "Father, Son, Holy Ghost, and Mrs. Spaulding, Amen." So he had it almost in the right order. In 1858, Chief Timothy saved Colonel Steptoe's troops from a massacre that could have been his greatest custers. And what happened is up in this area, Rosea, but this is Spokane over here, and this is what we call the Inland Empire. It's a big area of eastern Washington. That's a separate state from the rest of it. Because I lived over there. They don't vote the way I do. They don't have the same religion I do and everything. And my mother-in-law's there too, besides. Anyway, down here, from Walla Walla to here, Colonel Steptoe sent his troops up to, and he was going to put down the Indian tribes. Well, all of them up in this area decided, Coeur d'Alene's and all of them got together, and they decided no, they were not going to let him come, so they surrounded him. And they were just about ready to massacre him when Chief Timothy was sent up by troops from Walla Walla to lead some of his warriors up. They found Colonel Steptoe's troops where they're surrounded. They found a secret passage that Timothy knew about. He brought them out and they saved over 200 of them, brought them safely back to Walla Walla. Later on, then, this is in 1858, Colonel Wright went up another route. He was pretty tricky. This is in the canyons up there, and so that's how they were trapped. Colonel Wright went up here near my hometown. This is my hometown spread right here. Close to that, and he surrounded them. He had howitzers, and he wiped them out. And in order to order to really show them up, he killed. They had about 1,000 horses, and he killed 950 of them right off the bat. Near Coeur d'Alene Lake, there's a monument to horse. They call it the Horse Slaughter Memorial. They got 50 horses, but the soldiers couldn't ride them. Only the Indians could, so then they killed the other 50. So they killed almost 1,000 horses. And that hurt the Indians more than anything else, because that was how they got by. That's the only way you travel in that wide open spaces, was by horses. And that put down the revolt.
Was Steptoe Butte now then, was that name, was it figure in there?
That's the only real monument we have named to an officer of the army that was defeated. Okay. But it is, Steptoe Butte. I don't think he used it so much. Those of you who have been there, it's pretty steep. You wind around and around to get up there. But it's a nice view, and you can see it for miles around. But it is named after Colonel Steptoe. And just below it, just north of it, is where he was surrounded. A little town of Rosea, and it's quite a place. If you want to see all of the Palouse country at one time, we don't have as many clouds over there as they do here. You can get up on the top of it. They have transmission towers and everything else on it. But there's a road winds around. It was owned by a farmer, and he donated to the state, so it's a state park now. Okay, Elkanah Walker, who was at Spokane up in the Inland Empire. He had a 16-page primer in this flathead language printed on his press at Lapaway. Now, this press is a very small. I've got bigger ones in my basement than Spaulding used, which my wife doesn't like when we move. But He printed also a translation of the Ten Commandments for the Indians, 10 chapters of Matthew, and a brief Spokane English dictionary. Now, Mary Walker is my favorite, and she was the stronger of the two at the Spokane mission. So she was the stronger. There's two women there. The other one wasn't too strong, Mrs. Ells. But Mary was the stronger, so she did a lot of the chores of this mission. She spent time providing the food by taking care of the livestock and raising garden crops. They had fruit trees, wheat, and grain crops she also took care of. They made cheese and butter from the cow's milk. Of course, each family was only allowed $300 a year for a living, so and they had to support a lot of the Indians who were on the mission. Indian help was not reliable. One time, the Indian girl helping Mary took leave, and Mary was so relieved at losing her that she wrote in her diary, "Felt this morning I could sing as heartily as any Methodist. There's better days coming for I feel it in my soul." Mary's chores including fixing chimneys, windows, and hearth, and her tub when it fell apart. She helped with the milking and care of the other livestock, and she was often, as the men folks were gone on the circuit, she was really alone at the mission. She corded her own bedstead, made soap, candles, and even laid brick. She did duties as a doctor and nurse, and this was not only at home, but also among the Indians. Mary Walker and Myra Ells were both cultured and well-educated. Mary had attended Maine Wesleyan Seminary at Kent's Hill. She was well-versed. Now listen to this. This is just an average woman in the days when they were supposed to be put down. In natural history, chemistry, botany, mental philosophy, mathematics, French, and Spanish. She became a taxidermist and prepared most of her husband Alcana's reports and letters, and probably sermons, the few he gave. She kept a very informative diary of her daily happenings for about 10 years. This book that it's about these four women, most of it is from her diary, and it's the most interesting thing. And the one I liked was the excerpt I took near the end of it. She says, "I arose about 5, had an early breakfast, got my housework done about 9, baked 6 loaves of bread, made a kettle of mush, and have now a suet pudding and beef boiling. My girl has ironed, and I have managed to put my clothes away and set my house in order. May the merciful be with me through the unexpected scene. 9 o'clock was delivered of another son." And that was her, she had a 6th child born shortly after the Whitman mission. She also did praying in public in the presence of men was a no-no for women in those times. That didn't stop Mary. And formal education of the Indians is also frowned on. Alcana Walker objected to Mary reading in her short periods of spare time. Typical good man, Lucy. Her 6th child was born shortly after the Whitman massacre in 1847, and she made an entry in her diary about a month after the massacre. It says, "I feel anxious to know what turn events are taking. How distant must be the reign of peace, universal peace over this world, this wicked world be?" She also wrote at one time in her diary, she says, "I often cried myself to sleep. I was a very lonely woman, but a very caring person." And I think the rest of us should be grateful for her. Spokane's first school. Now, this is, we didn't start in Spokane very early. So the Spokane Gary that I mentioned started the school about 1830. And then Alcana Walker took over. Mary's husband took over about the end of the 1830s. And this Gary, the Spokane Indian, died in 1892. And if any of you play golf, there's an Indian Canyon golf course, and that's where he lived. You been there, Paul? Yeah. That was named after Spokane Gary. I don't know what his Indian name is. It's about that long. We had some others. Reverend James H. Wilbur, who was happened to be a Methodist, first came to Fort Simcoe, and that's up in Yakima. It's just between Yakima and Toppenish, right close to Toppenish. White's Lawn is where he was. It's right close to this 13. Anyway, they call him Father Wilbur, although he was a Methodist. pastor. And he came to the Valley about 1859. He spent over 20 years with the Yakima Indians. He was over 6 foot tall, and I got a picture of him over there. He weighed nearly 300 pounds, but that was all muscle. It wasn't fat. With his muscular arms, he could plow fields, calm crowds, and preach the gospel of ease. In 1860, he established a weekday secular school and preached on Sundays Christianity to local white settlers as well as with the Indians. Most of the white settlers married Indians so they'd have rights because that was the Indian mission. Most of your lower, what we call the Lower Yakima Valley, is part of the Yakima Indian reservations. And they did not allow whites to hold title to it. However, if you married an Indian maiden, then you were allowed to at least farm on it. In 1862, the superintendent of Indian Affairs, Benjamin F. Kendall, fired Father Wilbur, as he was known, as the Indian agent with Yakima. Well, everybody rose up against it, and so it ended up, Kendall got fired. Then Father Wilbur returned to Fort Simcoe as superintendent of instructions. Now this Kendall, I ran into another story about him. I hate to mention this, Paul, but he was a lawyer and also an editor, that's a double jeopardy. He ended up as a Steilacoom newspaper editor and lawyer, and one irate victim of one of Kendall's editorials later shot and killed the editor, and they never did catch him, or at least they never convicted him, as far as I know. And this was in 1863, January 7th, when Kendall was murdered. So they treated people pretty rough in the old days. If they didn't like what you wrote, they took care of things. This Father Wilbur could physically subdue Indians and whites alike. And often, whenever a bootlegger or a liquor dealer would get on the reservation, he'd take a bullwhip to him, and he'd drive him off the reservation. And if the same way with the Indians, if they tried to do the same thing. He was very harsh, but he was well-liked. We had another Methodist, Brother Mac. I'll just briefly mention him. He was raised in the 1850s among the Indians, wild bear, and hellfire religion near the mouth of Columbia River. He bordered on poverty most of his preaching career. He once sold his boots to buy food. He was once threatened with another preacher in the 1885 Seattle anti-Chinese riots. And the rioters were getting ready to beat up this Reverend John Dennison when Mac showed up, and that Mac looked so raunchy that he scared the life out of him, evidently, because his clothes were ragged. He only bought clothes once a year with his brother's help. His brother gave him the money to do it. He walked his circuits for 33 years. He couldn't afford a horse or a canoe to assist him. And he preached in many small towns in the Puget Sound, most of them up and down and as far down as the Columbia River. Towns like Langley, which is on Whidbey Island, Kalama was where the Northern Pacific Railroad started in 1873, and the Columbia River, Duval, and places in between. One time, he was kind of brave, one time he preached on closing the saloons with a fire and brimstone temperance lecture on Friday Harbor, which is up in the San Juans. At his next stop, his life was threatened by the inhabitants, and they transferred him out before he got killed. He wrote a journal of his activities until August 1924. He wrote it almost every day of his life. He died in 1936 at 88, ending his endless tale of woe. And there's a book out about Brother Mac, and if you ever get a chance to read it in the library, do so. It's a wonderful story. He didn't have money to go to our annual conferences. Methodists have to have an annual conference to reassign their preachers. Mm-hmm. So his brother would clean him up and buy him a new suit of clothes, and that would last for a whole year. He built churches and everything else with it. One of our favorites is Mother Joseph, and we briefly mentioned her. She was a Canadian. She belonged to the Order of the Sisters of Providence. She came to Oregon in December 1856, and this is about 9 years after the massacre at Whitman's memorial. Whitman, and that's when he had the first memorial and she had the second. They took a five-week trip by boat, 6,000 miles journey, and she colleagues from New York, and they looked for death as a release from the unrelenting seasickness and wild winter weather. They arrived in Oregon in December. She was given the name of Mother, and she built all these different institutions, including the ones I mentioned. She used her on-the-job skills to build these projects, and she was a carpenter herself. She'd run out of money, and so when she was in Steilacoom, she'd run down to the saloons, and she'd go around the saloons. She got enough money to get some more nails and boards, and she'd go back. And so she built this convent. It was this two-story one. And those of you who've been to Steilacoom, we have this little Catholic church which is built at Fort Steilacoom during the Indian Wars. And afterwards, in 1864, it was taken apart board by board, hauled to Steilacoom, reassembled. Well, then Mother Joseph came along, and she decided to build a convent next door to it, which she did. The convent burned about the turn of the century, but there's a house on there that looks identical to that convent. It's a two-story, it's got a railing and everything. I thought it was, but another fellow and I went out to measure it, and we found out it was back about 20 feet from the original building. I'm going to mention Lutherans because there is one or two here, I understand. And this is this book is quite a bit of Lutheran information. But where I got a lot of other information was from a Russian-German book that was put out by a professor who is a superintendent of schools at Endicott in the Palouse country. He's a German-Russian himself, and so he wrote a very good book that I'll have when we do the ethnic groups. It says here about Lutheran churches, many early Scandinavians in Washington State were sailors and fishermen, so the Lutheran pastors organized several missions to fill their needs. Some were furnished a room and board, and received and posted their mail, stored their valuables, and so forth, and then they enabled them to hear the ministers in their native tongue. At the example, Seattle Ballard District at one time had no less than 27 Lutheran churches. Mm-hmm. Now, Ballard's not very big, so every other block must have had a Lutheran church. And knowing some Lutherans, sometimes they don't always get along, and so I imagine there's several different denominations or several divisions of the Lutheran church. They had, and also they didn't trust colleges, so they had a whole string of them that they established at one time. They had one called the Norwegian Pacific Lutheran University, which is the one that's still there. They had Lutheran Free Church Bethany High School in Paulsville. They had Concordia College in Portland by the Missouri Synod. They had the 1907 Spokane College by the United Norwegian Church. They had the 1907 Coeur d'Alene College, Idaho, by the Augustana Synod. 1909, they had the Columbia College in Everett by the United Norwegian Church. By 1919, only two of them left. Concordia was left, and the Pacific Lutheran University, which is still there. And I think they're about ready to celebrate their centennial. They're not very far off, anyway. They had one moved from Portland to Seattle in 1914. That was Pacific Theological Seminary. And then they had one that moved, it opened up, but one opened up and closed in 3 years. Lutheran pastors in 1900 were unhappy with the fact that only 5,000 of the 15,000 Scandinavians in the state were in their churches. They got around the rest of us sinners, we sinners, and they stayed out of the churches. And the pastors were unhappy. Many of the German immigrants from the Russian Volga had come to America, and they revolted at the strict ecclesiastical rigidity of the Lutheran Church in Russia. And so they became other. They arrived, they became German Congregationalists. They joined the Methodist, the Episcopal, Reformed, and Seventh-day Adventist churches. The most successful Scandinavian missions in the area were those undertaken by the Methodists and the Baptists. In 1910, there were 18 Lutheran churches in Seattle. The Reverend Hans Stubb in 1903 had only 11 parishioners in the Seattle Emmanuel Lutheran Church. He was an organizer, and by 1912, 9 years later, he had 300 members in his church. At that time, it was the largest Norwegian church on the West Coast. In 1918, Lutherans became members of the Seattle Federation of Churches along with 60 other congregations and 12 different denominations. And so they joined the rest of us. I'm going into the wagon trains, and this is the part that really, I thought was really interesting. The wagon trains came on the Oregon Trail. I don't have much of it to show here. They came, and they touched into Washington, right by Walla Walla. They came over the Blue Mountains, and they got the Blue Mountains across them just as the snow started in October. And then they had to go 300 miles down to Portland, and the trail goes along here. Quite often, see, they didn't have any dams, so they had a lot of rapids and cascades and so forth, and so they made boats. And quite often, the boats would tip over and drown. They made boats at the Fort Walla Walla, which is a Catholic Hudson Bay Company, and then they'd go all the way down the Columbia River. Finally, they found out that a better way was to go around Mount Hood into the Willamette Valley by wagon. They had the Barlow Road, and Barlow was pretty smart. He made it a toll road. He took most of the stumps out, not all of them, and then he charged them the fare to go through. So much for each cow and so forth. One of the reasons they said for coming out west on the wagon trains was greed, need for plunder, and inspired by religious fervor. The land was getting crowded. My ancestors were originally from Kentucky, then they went into Missouri, they went into Arkansas. They were there about almost 27 years, and then they went to Texas, and that was where my great-grandmother was born. They went into Texas 1836, and you remember that was when the Alamo fell, and they were up in the northern part of Texas, and they stayed there until they came out west in 1843. They joined people from all over the Midwest, a lot of them from the south in Missouri, and they left late in 1843 because of the heavy rains, and they had to wait until the grass came up in the prairies so they'd have something to feed the cattle and oxen and so forth that they had. The vehicles used by the migrations, or the wagons as they called them, they were by necessity much smaller than the Conestogas that they always show on TV. Those huge wagons would have never made it. They were small. They were actually only about 11 feet long, between 11 and 12 feet long. And they were topped with a 5-foot high hickory hoops covered with canvas or oilcloth. Very few people rode in them. They were crammed with supplies. They had to have so much meat, all salted and stored in barrels, flour and bacon. And anybody except the newborn babies and some of the pregnant women walked. They walked the whole 2,000 miles. My ancestors left with 9 children. One of them was 3 months old when they left, and they didn't have any diapers, to change, disposable. They had to wash them along the way, and that was miserable because they had to stop at rivers and wash their clothing, what little they had. By the time they arrived in Oregon, many of the kids were barefooted by the time they arrived, but their feet were like soles of shoes by the time they got there. My ancestors were about 1 week into it, and they got across the Kaw River, and it was a high river because of the heavy rains, and so they had a ferry across. Well, most of the pioneers had their wagon boxes made so you could float across with them like boats. They had tarred joints and everything else. But this was too swift for them, so they had to make ferries. What they did is they put about 3 canoes together and they put a platform on it. And a fellow by the name of Papa, he was a French-Canadian, I think, was running a ferry service. So my ancestors put their wagon or two on there and all their kids. They got halfway over and it capsized. And they lost all their household goods. And my great-great-grandmother hung into the yoke of the wagon and was finally picked up down the river. All the kids were picked up by Indians who were on the bank. And they dove in and saved my kids, including my great-grandmother, who I've ever since been grateful. It was a long journey. I may not have been here. I might have been a Lutheran or a Baptist or something. Yeah, there's lots of blessings. Paul and I have had some discussions. Historian George Himes estimated that 30,000 immigrants died on the Oregon Trail between 1837 and 1859. This is nearly 10% of the 300,000 who made the journey. They got into Utah, then, or near Utah, then some of them went to California and some went to Oregon. It was said that this is equivalent to one grave for every 80 yards of the trail from the Missouri River to the Willamette. I followed quite a bit of it over the years, and quite often there'll be a little monument, just a brick or something with just a name or a date, and you know it was there. Quite often they buried them on the trail itself, because the wolves and stuff would dig up the bodies, and they didn't want the Indians to do it. The Indians would dig them up and take the blankets and stuff off of them for their own use. And that's how so many of the Indians got the diseases. Most of these people died from diseases or accidents, very few from the Indians. The only big year that I saw for Indian slaughter was in 1862, Alamo, right on the Utah-Idaho border. 300 of them were surrounded and killed. And what started off is they saw some Indians riding by, and so some of the wild ones in the wagon train shot and killed one of them. And so all the Indians in the area gathered around and they put a siege on them, and there's no water or anything. So they dug a well, and they didn't reach water, but the hand dug well. And that well was so big that after they were killed, a rescue party came along, and they buried them in this well, all 300 of them. That was the only major group I know of. Quite often, the Indians would attack a smaller group, they have two or three wagons, just to steal their livestock or steal whatever they had. The Indians were the least of their problems. And I want to mention who was on the first 1843 wagon train. And that was what we call the greatest one, because that was the first one to go to Oregon all the way. Before that, they had to use pack horses or little carts. They had Peter Burnett, who became the first governor of California, William Gilpin, who became the first governor of Colorado, James Neesmith, who became the first U.S. senator from Oregon, Morton McCarver, who founded Tacoma, and then, of course, Dr. Marcus Whitman led that group most of the way, because he had been over it several times on foot. And, of course, Alexander and Sarah Zachary, my relatives, were on that. I thought it was interesting that the women didn't think so much of we men on this. So they had a book called Women's Diaries of the Westward Journey. And it was authored by Lillian Schissel. Anybody's interested, I'll give you the number. She wrote, "The diaries of men and women carry certain predictable characteristics, with men writing of fights, conflicts, competition, and hunting, and women writing their concerns with family and relational values. In the diaries of the women, the Indians were described as helpful guides and purveyors of service, less as enemies. Husbands weren't often successful hunters. Rituals of care of the sick and the injured was by the women. And the women saw that the real enemies of the road were disease and accidents. Cholera was widespread during travel on the trail. And they wrote of how bleak it was when the sick were being left by the side of the trail to either recover or die, and many were abandoned that way. They wrote of the deaths and the burials. They tell of typhoid, mountain fever, measles, dysentery, and drownings. And they noted the particulars of each gravesite, whether it was new or old." Now, I have James Neesmith wrote a diary and mentioned my ancestors. He didn't mention one single death that I know of in that diary. And he wrote a very concise diary. They noted whether it was a young or old person that died, whether it was disturbed by Indians or wolves. And these were the actuaries of the road. They were the ones that kept, they were the same as our Census Bureau and our assessors and appraiser. Finally, it is suspected that many women judged the heroic adventure of their men as some kind of outrageous folly thrust upon them by obedience to patriarchal ritual. So if you women want to read that book, well, you may do so. This, I knew my great-grandmother. She was 5 years old when she started out on the trip, about six before she got to the end of it. She lived with my grandfather and his father, and she died when she was 96. I knew her because I was 13 years old when she died. She knew three languages. She knew the English. She knew Chinook jargon. She knew Chinese. She ran a boarding house at the Dalles, which is down the Columbia River. And it was most of the customers were Chinese laborers that built the railroads. And so she knew the Chinese language. And then when she moved to Ellensburg, well, one of the first restaurants up there was by a Chinese family. And I think the Chinese family still has one restaurant up there in Ellensburg. Anyway, she was quite a person, tough. She survived a near drowning, you know, and she survived the Indian War, 1855, down at the, in Oregon at the Cascades. She was down in that area of the Cascade blockhouse. She survived the Yakima Indian Wars, which lasted until 1858. She survived her... Her children were spread all over. One of her sons was in a mine accident, and so she took care of him until he died. He was got too close to a dynamite explosion in a mine. One son, her oldest brother, or next oldest brother, Robert, was the one that the vigilantes caught in 1864 and hung as a road agent. I found a book in the library, and here it has 12 pages of the story of my ancestor. I can't find any of the good ones, but I did of him. So that's you may take a look in the, as you go in. There's 970 series. It's mostly of the West. It has a lot of Alaska and a lot of Seattle, and so I found several books that I copied. Another one is one on Chief Seattle's speech. Now Chief Seattle has made a speech. About 1854, he talked to Governor Isaac Stevens. Isaac Stevens was coming around to the all the Indians in the Washington Territory, and for the main purpose to have a railroad right-of-way. And in order to get a right-of-way, you had to get the land away from the Indians. And so he wanted them to get them on reservations, and then the rest of the land would be a right-of-way for the railroads. So that was his main job. He was sent out as a surveyor in 1853 and became a governor in 1854 and made all the treaties at the, up and down the coast and as far as Walla Walla and into Idaho. That was what he was looking for. But Chief Seattle didn't like it. He says, "How can I sell the air above his where his lands were?" He says, this land belongs to God and doesn't belong to man. Man is a part of the land. The man's land is not a part of man. And so he wrote this, or gave this speech. And I've loaned the book out, and that's, I guess it's back in the library. But it's about three translations of it. The original one was copied by a doctor, Professor Smith was his name. And he wrote it in what was the Indian language itself. Stevens was stubborn, and he would not accept any signatures or anything else or a conversation unless it was the Chinook jargon, which is only 300 words, and you can distort it quite a bit. Chief Seattle, which his name was spelled actually, S-E-A-T-H-L. Chief Seattle didn't know the Chinook jargon. He wouldn't use it because he wasn't a Chinook. And so he used it in his own language. Smith copied it down, and then later on they copied it into the jargon, and then finally they put it in English. And each time they did that, the translation changed, and so it's nothing like. But it was it's a good one, and you should read it sometime. It's not very long. It'll only take you about 5 minutes to read it. It and Chief Joseph's "I'll never fight, I won't fight nevermore." Speech is another good one. The railroads, and briefly, I better be quickly. As I mentioned, Isaac Stevens came out here to survey it. Now I better stop right now. Anybody have any comments or questions, or before I get into the railroad? I was a railroader, so that I may get off the track, so to speak. We have, well, you know, if have any of you got pioneers who came out wagon train or immigrant train? See, we had three ways of getting to the Washington Territory. The first way was by sailing vessel, and that took months, and everybody got sick, and it was expensive. So very few could come out. Yes?
A lot of events here happened in the 1860s. Were there any people who were, like, moving from Missouri and so on, or getting away from the Civil War?
Yes.
I mean, I wonder whether that was one reason for
it. Yeah, it was so bad during the Civil War that in 1864, Iowa passed a law that you couldn't leave the state going west unless you had a pass. Mm-hmm. That was because so many deserters were going. Okay. Most of the Civil War affected, and I'll be talking about that a little later, about the Civil War, what it affected. They actually ran a ship around that sank a lot of our supply ships and stuff off the coast during the Civil War. And we had no warships over here to protect it. The first...
My grandfather was sent from the Mission Society in Germany to the Russian Germans that you mentioned.
Okay.
But he's rather recent compared to... He came, I think, in 91.
Okay, we'll be doing that. Yeah, we'll be doing, and some even later than that. That'll be in my ethnic one, which will be on Friday, I think it is. Yeah, Friday.
He reminded me of him because he was joined shortly after he came by another pastor named Horn. That made two of them, so they had to have a convention, which was held in my grandfather's home. And the minutes from that meeting record that it was late in starting in the morning. It was late because Grandmother Smith had been late in getting up to get breakfast. The reason she was late in getting breakfast was that my great uncle, was born during the night and she was just sluggish.
Those women they don't cooperate, do they? That was. That type of thing was fairly common, evidently, you know, that anybody else of it. I was supposed to let people share. I have quite a session on German-Russians, which will be on Friday. They are the most interesting people. We have a lot of them in Eastern Washington. And there's a professor who wrote several books that I've got copies of. Sherman was his name, and he's a superintendent principal at Endicott. I know some of his teachers that work on him, and they say he's a dictator. He gives them work to do, you know, doing his own historical novels and stuff he writes. But he's done a real in-depth study of the German Russians. And all I can tell you about that is Catherine the Great imported Germans to the Volga River to farm it because they were such good farmers. And they were promised not to be drafted. They didn't have to pay taxes. And they had a land ownership. Well, that was changed later when they had some czars came in, some men came in and changed it. But that's basically why a lot of them came after Catherine the Great died. Okay, the railroads. First one was Union Pacific, Central Pacific, and that was completed in 1869. And that came into the central part of the United States. They decided they needed one in the northern part. So the Northern Pacific Railroad had a charter during the Civil War. Lincoln signed a charter. And it was started 1873. It started from Kalama, which is down right in here, close to Kelso. And it ran all the way to Tacoma, 1873. Everybody got excited when it got out to close to where my church is at Lakewood. They got excited because Seattle wanted the termination, Olympia wanted the termination, and Everett, all of them wanted the termination of the railroad, and they didn't get it. Tacoma had the best offer, gave land and everything else, and so Tacoma did get the, at 1873. We had a little railroad in Walla Walla, which is down at the junction of the Snake and Columbia. He couldn't wait for the railroad to get there, and so he built his own railroad. He didn't have any steel rails or anything, so he used wooden rails, and that wore too fast. So he put strips of rawhide on it, Well, the coyotes and the wolves came along and ate all his rice. And then, so he couldn't run his trains, you know. He ran it for about 4 or 5 years until the Northern Pacific came into Pasco. And then they ran a branch line out there. But they called that the Rawhide Railroad. Doc Baker, he was a veterinarian. So he probably knew about coyotes and so forth. The Rawhide Railroad. The Great Northern came across the state in 1893, came into Seattle, and Seattle was happy. Up to that time, Tacoma had a plus on shipping because they had a transcontinental railroad coming in, and Seattle didn't. What helped Seattle after that, after 1893, was they were still supplying gold miners up in Canada and as well as the Yukon. They celebrated this event in Seattle, James Hill's Great Northern, on July 4th, 1893. At the same time, that's when we had one of our big depressions, 1893. So I don't know what kind of celebration. The Milwaukee came in, and Milwaukee runs, the Northern Pacific runs down like this, then up. That's the way it did. Now it runs down here, and it doesn't go up beyond Yakima anymore. Although the tracks are still there. Milwaukee came almost straight across, but it came late. And when it came late, there was no market. You've got to have feeder markets into it. And so the Milwaukee didn't last too long. It came in 1909, and then about the 1970s, it finally folded up. But it was the most direct route, and it wouldn't have been ideal. The Burlington Northern now wants to run their, rebuild that track between Ellensburg and Lind, which is right close to the central part of central Washington. They want to run that in, and they may do that. And that's a real direct route. Okay, the Northern Pacific was hard to deal with. They were the first one through, so they got a lot of land grant land. Most of the Weyerhaeuser land in the state of Washington was traded from the Northern Pacific Railroad. They traded it for different things or sold. They got every other section of land wherever they built a railroad. And so they built railroads like mad. You know, they put the trains couldn't actually run on the rails. So some of them were built so fast that they weren't too safe. But you got the land, you know, that's what they were after. And then they took the land, and when they could sell it, then they could finance the railroad. And that's the only way they could finance it, was by that. The Northern Pacific got into Yakima Valley, and Yakima Valley is, of course, out of Portland. Down below here is called Union Gap now, but just below Yakima Union was where the town was, Yakima City, they called it. They argued with the Northern Pacific. They wouldn't give them they wanted to charge them too much for a station. So the railroad moved up to North Yakima, as they called it, and they established a town. Well, then right away, all the merchants in Yakima City loaded all they put their buildings and houses and so forth on rollers, and they rolled them up 4 miles up to, and as they went along, they sold the merchants, they sold feed and everything else as they went along. So, and then another thing is, in 1889, and this is after the Northern Pacific came in at Walla Walla, 6 Walla Walla residents were arrested for fraud, and their crime was driving worthless cattle in front of trains and then charging the railroad the price of prime beef. I was raised in the wheat country in Sprague, and they did the same thing there. We had our trains used to go by a wheat field near Sprague Lake, which is it's called Colville Lake on the map. Sprague Lake. This land was, every year the train would go by, and quite often they'd set fire by the train, but sometimes the farmers would burn it. But every year it was 50 bushel per acre wheat, and the railroad had to pay for it. That's what they figured. After we started put diesels on and there wasn't any more fires, it turned out to be between 20 and 25 bushels of wheat is all they could get off of it. So they were robbing the railroad for many years. Okay, this is it. Thanks for coming.